It was the summer of 2001. Usher's You Remind Me was the number one song in America. Destiny's Child had just dropped Bootylicious, an anthem that seemed to be playing on every radio station. But life in Richmond, Indiana, wasn't lived through streaming apps or smartphones. Cell phones were still clunky flip phones or candy bar Nokias. Most people relied on pagers, beepers, or landlines to stay in touch. For Nikki McCown, it meant that staying connected was limited. But her Sundays were always predictable. Church in the morning, laundry in the afternoon, and planning the wedding of her dreams. On July 22nd, she was just 3 weeks away from walking down the aisle. It was Sunday, and her routine for the day had already begun. She went to church in the morning. Later that afternoon, she dropped her daughter, Peyton, off at her mother's house before heading to the laundromat. Nikki started her wash, then returned briefly to her mother's home. She was visibly agitated, pacing, clearly uncomfortable. But before long, she left again, telling her mother, "I'll be back." Her laundry was nearly finished. By 3 o'clock, her fiancé, Bobby Webster, came home, expecting to find her there. But her sandals weren't by the door. An hour passed. Then another. He started calling her sisters. None of them had seen her. By nightfall, worry turned to panic. Nikki hadn't come back for her 9-year-old daughter. She never missed that. The family jumped in their cars, searching the streets of Richmond. No cell phone to call. No GPS to trace. No sign of her anywhere. By morning, there was nothing left to do but report her missing. And just like that, the simple rhythm of a summer Sunday shattered. She was gone. This is the story of Nikki McCown. It is a story of suspicion, misdirection, and a truth hidden in plain sight. Hello, and welcome to today's episode of Sleuthy Stories. If you're new here, this is the podcast where real-life mysteries unfold, one clue at a time. The audio for today's story has been pulled from my main YouTube channel and remastered for this podcast experience. If you'd like to see the visuals that accompany this case, head over to my YouTube channel, Sleuthy Lucy. But for now, sit back, listen closely, and let's unravel the mystery together. Thanks for being here. Well, hello, and welcome back. I'm so glad you're here with me today. If you haven't already, make sure to hit follow so you never miss an episode. Today's case is part of our unfinished series, stories where decades pass, families keep searching, and still the truth hasn't come to light. This is the story of Marilyn Renee Nicole McCown. To her family and friends, she was simply Nikki, 28 years old, a mother, a bride-to-be in Richmond, Indiana. A woman whose future seemed just within reach, until it wasn't. She was just 3 weeks from walking down the aisle, balancing wedding plans with raising her 9-year-old daughter, Peyton. But one ordinary Sunday in July 2001, she vanished. And what began as a quiet afternoon of laundry and errands unraveled into one of Indiana's most haunting mysteries. So let's go back to that summer day. To the moment when a young mother's plans for the future were cut short, and her family's search for answers began. July 22nd, 2001 had started like so many Sundays before. Nikki went to church with her family, her daughter Peyton by her side. After the service, she dropped Peyton off at her mother's house, then headed to the Richmond Coin Laundry, just off of Southeast Street in Richmond, Indiana. Her fiancé, Bobby, had plans of his own that afternoon. He and his cousin Billy, his best man, were going to the mall to get fitted for tuxedos. Nikki said she'd use the time to knock out the laundry, something she always reserved for Sundays. Bobby told her he'd be back by 4 or 5 o'clock that evening. They were supposed to sit down and go over wedding invitations. For Nikki, the day was full. Laundry, errands, and later, meeting at her sister Tammy's to work on wedding details. She had it all mapped out. But when she stopped back at her mother's house after going to the laundromat, her demeanor was different. Agitated, upset, pacing. She told her mom that two Hispanic men at the laundromat had been bothering her, harassing her. Her clothes were still in the dryer, but her mother tried to calm her nerves. "Just bring them home," she suggested. "Finish them downstairs," she said. Nikki shook her head. "The laundry was nearly done," she said. "She'd be right back." "I'll be back, Mom." Her mother, Barbara, didn't think much of it. After all, Nikki was a beautiful woman. Men noticed her. Men sometimes made comments. It was uncomfortable, yes. But in Barbara's mind, it wasn't unusual. So she watched her daughter walk out the door again. Back to the laundromat. Back to where her clothes were tumbling in the dryer. Around 3 o'clock that afternoon, Nikki's fiancé Bobby stopped by her sister Tammy's house. He was driving Nikki's black Toyota Camry. The two had swapped vehicles for the day. Tammy was outside, working in her yard, when Bobby pulled up. This was where they had planned to meet later, at Tammy's, to go over wedding invitations. But instead of Nikki stepping out of the car, it was Bobby who rolled up. "Hey, sis," he asked. "Have you seen Nikki?" Tammy looked up, puzzled. "No," she told him. She hadn't seen her sister all afternoon. But she didn't think much of it. This was before smartphones and constant communication. You couldn't just track someone's location with an app or fire off a quick text. In fact, Nikki didn't even have a cell phone. So when Tammy said she hadn't seen her, Bobby left. At that moment, there wasn't yet a reason for alarm. But that would soon change. By 4:30, Bobby had returned home from the mall. But something felt off. He didn't see his truck, and the laundry Nikki had been working on wasn't there either. Her sandals, the ones she always slipped off at the doorway, were missing too. At first, he brushed it off. For that first hour, he told himself she was probably running late, maybe caught up in some last-minute wedding shopping. Nikki could lose track of time, and there were still plenty of errands to finish before the big day. But as the clock pushed toward 6 and 7 with still no call, Bobby began to worry. His unease was growing heavier. Even though no one had been able to get in touch with Nikki, there still wasn't much cause for alarm. This was Nikki. She was known to drop off the radar for short stretches. She was the spur of the moment type, the kind of person who wouldn't always say where she was going. She'd just hop in the car and take off, not putting too much thought into it. So when Tammy realized she hadn't seen her sister, she didn't worry. She decided to go see the new Jet Li movie, Kiss of the Dragon. 3 hours later, she was back home. That's when the phone rang. It was Bobby again, only this time his voice carried a different edge. "Tammy, have you seen or heard from Nikki?" "No, not yet, Bobby," she answered. "Maybe she went to check on the wedding dresses or something. Sometimes she does that." Bobby said he'd check back later. As soon as she hung up, Tammy felt a twinge of worry. She picked up the phone again, this time calling their sister, Michelle. "Have you heard from Nikki?" "No," Michelle replied. As the evening crept closer to 7, Michelle stopped by Tammy's house. The sisters sat together talking when Tammy brought it up. "Have you seen Nikki?" she asked. Michelle looked puzzled. "No, I ain't seen Nikki." "Why? What's wrong?" Tammy explained. "Bob's been calling around. He can't find her." Michelle waved it off at first. "She's probably off shopping or something." But even as she said it, the words didn't settle right. Nikki had a daughter waiting at her mother's house. She had wedding invitations still to finish. She had plans that evening. And yet, no one had heard from her. When Nikki was late to pick up her daughter Peyton, her mother didn't panic. She assumed Nikki must have gone into work or gotten caught up with something important. Oh, she's all right, Barbara thought to herself. You know how Nikki is. Sometimes she'll just, on the spur of the moment, jump in her car and head over to Ohio. She worked there, after all. Meanwhile, back at the apartment where Nikki lived with Bobby and Peyton, there was nothing to suggest her absence was anything more than temporary. No signs of a struggle. No clues left behind. Just silence, stretching longer as the night wore on. When night fell, the calm of the day gave way to fear. Everyone was now on edge. By 10 o'clock, Bobby could no longer shake the sense that something was very wrong. Hours had passed with no word from Nikki. No visits to her sisters. No calls to her mother. And no sign of his GMC Jimmy 4x4, the vehicle she had been driving that afternoon. His mind began racing. Maybe she'd been in an accident. Maybe she was stranded somewhere. The explanations spun, but none of them explained why she hadn't called, why she hadn't picked up her daughter. The unease that had started as a whisper was now undeniable. Something wasn't right. As the clock crept past 10 and into the late hours, the unease could no longer be brushed aside. Bobby, her sisters, and her mother all knew this wasn't like Nikki. She would never leave her daughter behind. So they got in their cars and began to search the streets of Richmond. They drove past the laundromat, past the places she might shop, through the neighborhoods she knew, hoping to spot Bobby's GMC Jimmy or catch sight of her walking. But every turn brought the same result. Nothing. By midnight, the hope that she'd simply lost track of time was gone. The night stretched into early morning, the family exhausted and frantic. And finally, they did the one thing they had been dreading, the act that made their fears real. They went to the police. Nikki McCown had vanished. Marilyn Renee Nicole McCown was born on January 6, 1973. She was the youngest of 10 children to Barbara and Harvey, and the baby of a large, close-knit family in Richmond, Indiana. Everyone called her Nikki. At 28 years old, she was stylish, smart, and hardworking, a woman who loved shopping, dressing well, and binging her favorite crime shows like Unsolved Mysteries and Snapped. Her father would say she was strong-willed. She had a 9-year-old daughter, Peyton, born when Nikki was 19, with her former boyfriend, Stephen Johnston. Though the relationship didn't last, Nikki embraced single motherhood with determination and love. Education was her passion. She studied criminal justice at her local community college and dreamed of joining the FBI or becoming a U.S. Marshal. In her career, she started out as a guard at the Montgomery Education and Pre-Release Center in Dayton, Ohio, and worked her way up to lead accounting clerk. She was even part of the facility's hostage negotiation team, a role that underscored just how capable and respected she was. But beneath the professional drive was a woman excited about the next chapter of her personal life. After reconnecting with her high school sweetheart, Bobby Webster, the spark between them reignited as if no time had passed. The two had dated for 3 years back in high school before going their separate ways. Bobby moved to California and had a son with another woman, while Nikki built a life of her own in Richmond, raising her daughter Peyton with her ex, Stephen Johnston. When Bobby eventually returned to Richmond, their paths crossed again, and the connection was instant. They continued falling in love, and by 2001, they were engaged, planning a wedding for August 18th. Nikki was thrilled to finally plan her dream wedding. Nikki was also managing Graves' disease, a thyroid condition that can cause rapid heartbeat, weight changes, fatigue, and even hair loss. Because of it, she required daily medication. When she vanished that summer, she left that medication behind. along with her wedding band. For her family, that was the clearest sign of all. She had too many responsibilities, a daughter to raise, a wedding to plan. Her family knew she wouldn't just leave it all behind. She needed that medicine every single day. And now she didn't have it. To them, it was undeniable proof. Nikki was in danger. When the McCown family walked into the Richmond Police Department that night, the words were heavy on their tongues. Our Nikki is missing. At first, officers treated it like many other cases of adults who vanish. She was 28 years old, healthy, with a car at her disposal. Maybe she had gone off on her own. Maybe she needed a break. Maybe she'd be back by morning. But her family pushed back. This wasn't just anyone. This was Nikki. She had a 9-year-old daughter waiting at her mother's house, a fiancé expecting her home, a wedding less than 3 weeks away. She didn't just walk away from all that. Still, in those first hours, police logged the report and offered reassurances they would keep an eye out. They would circulate her description. But to the McCowns, it felt like the urgency hadn't sunk in. And so the family left the station with the same gnawing fear they'd carried in. Nikki wasn't just late. She wasn't just off shopping. Something had happened. That night, Nikki's family felt helpless. They searched, they called, they pleaded for answers, but detectives didn't share their sense of urgency. So her sister Michelle came up with a measure of her own. Nikki might slip away from family for a few hours, but she would never skip work. Work was her anchor. If she didn't clock in on Monday morning, something was terribly wrong. At sunrise on July the 23rd, Michelle drove to the Montgomery Pre-Release Center in Dayton, where Nikki worked in accounting. She asked if her sister had checked in. The answer was no. Michelle broke down right there in the office. When Barbara heard the news, she walked outside and paced the front yard, her voice lifting to the sky. Where could she be? Lord, please bring her home. The fear that had taken root overnight was only sharper. The family began retracing her steps, piecing together where she'd last been seen. Their focus turned to the Richmond Coin Laundry. Just the day before, Nikki had told her mother she was uncomfortable, pacing, upset, saying two men had been bothering her while she waited for her clothes to finish drying. Barbara had urged her to bring the laundry home, to finish it in the basement where she could be safe. But Nikki had waved her off. The clothes were almost done, she said. She'd be right back. Now, standing in the daylight of a new day, that decision loomed heavier. That afternoon, the family managed to locate surveillance footage from a deli near the laundromat, the village pantry. On the tape, Nikki could be seen stopping in, picking up what looked like a Coke. At that moment, nothing seemed unusual. She appeared calm, going about her day. In fact, the video reinforced the police's first impression. Maybe she had just gone off on her own. The camera even showed her car sitting in the lot. Then it captured her walking back, loading clothes into the vehicle, and pulling away. She did not appear to be under duress. But the tape also showed something else. An unknown man lingered at the edge of the frame. He peered into the store after her and then walked in the same direction she had gone. For her family, that shadowy figure planted a seed of dread. For investigators, it was just another reason to believe there was nothing to worry about. Police followed up on Barbara's account of two men hassling Nikki at the laundromat. But when they canvassed the area, no one remembered seeing an argument. No one reported any trouble outside the building. On paper, it looked routine. So detectives leaned into another theory. Maybe Nikki had left by choice. Maybe she and Bobby had fought. Maybe the wedding pressure had been too much. Cold feet, they suggested. Her family didn't believe it for a second. Nikki adored her 9-year-old daughter, Peyton. There was no world in which she'd simply abandon her. And the wedding? That was her dream. She had poured herself into the planning, savoring every detail. The idea that she just walked away didn't make sense, not to the people who knew her best. The McCown family wasn't about to sit and wait. They pounded the pavement themselves, knocking on doors, handing out flyers, retracing every path Nikki might have taken. By the third day, the weight of her absence was undeniable. Even police began to shift. Her failure to show up for work, the one thing she never missed, was a turning point. Detectives started working the case more aggressively. They checked motels, made calls, canvassed the laundromat and surrounding blocks. A few people remembered seeing Nikki folding her clothes. Others mentioned two men who might have hassled her. But none of it gave investigators a real lead. Her bank accounts sat untouched. From the air, a helicopter swept across Richmond and into Dayton. But even with that reach, there was no trace of her SUV. And with nothing concrete to go on, detectives did what investigators often do. They turned inward, toward the person closest to her, her fiancé, Bobby Webster. From the start, Bobby Webster was right in the middle of the timeline. On the day Nikki vanished, the two had swapped vehicles. She drove his GMC Jimmy 4x4 while he kept her black Toyota Camry. He told police he had been out with his cousin Billy, his best man, getting fitted for tuxedos. Later that afternoon, he expected to meet up with Nikki at Tammy's to work on invitations. But Nikki never showed. In those first hours, Bobby did what seemed reasonable. He checked with her sisters. He drove around looking for her. He called again when the hours stretched longer. And when nothing turned up, he joined the family in their search and reports to the police. But investigators soon became baffled by what they were hearing about his behavior in the days that followed. The very next day, Bobby called the community college where Nikki was taking classes, demanding her unused tuition money. When the staff explained there was nothing to refund, that her courses were being covered by her employer, he became so irate that the head of the department had to step in and calm him down. By Wednesday, detectives learned he had gone to the jewelry store where Nikki had purchased his wedding ring. He tried to return it, but because her name was on the receipt, the store refused. Not long after, he even tried pawning his own engagement ring. Another red flag. On the very day Nikki vanished, Bobby had taken the time to wash her car. For investigators, that detail stopped them cold. Why would a man whose fiancé had just disappeared be scrubbing down her vehicle? Was he trying to cover something up? Was it guilt? Or was it simply an odd attempt to keep busy while he waited for news? The timing felt wrong. The optics were worse. And in a case with almost no physical evidence, those small decisions carried weight. By midweek, the unease around Bobby's actions only deepened. Police confirmed he had canceled the wedding and demanded the deposits back. For investigators, it was a trail of red flags. And when word of Bobby's actions reached Nikki's family, their anger only grew. He's talking about canceling the wedding like he knew she wasn't coming back. The suspicion around Bobby Webster was only intensifying, so detectives bring Bobby down to the station, suspicious of his behavior. They confront him with everything they've learned, the tuition calls, the rings, the cancellations. Bobby had an answer for everything. He tells them he never said the wedding was canceled. Right now, the last thing on my mind is the wedding. I want Nikki. The wedding is second to that, he said. He pushes back on the tuition story. Yes, I asked about her student loan, but I wasn't trying to get it, he said. And when it comes to the rings, he frames it as practical. I just wanted the deposit back so I could buy a cell phone. We don't have one. And with all this running around, I thought it would help us. As for the car, Bobby says there was nothing suspicious about it at all. He had promised Nikki he'd wash it, and in his mind, he was simply keeping that promise. Detectives listen, but the explanations don't erase the doubts. They ask Bobby to take a polygraph. One of the questions is blunt. Did you have anything to do with the disappearance of Nikki McCown, or do you know anything about her disappearance? Bobby answers, no. The lines on the chart jumped violently, a signal the operator read as clear. Bobby wasn't being truthful. Despite the red flags, and even the troubling polygraph results, police couldn't make an arrest. They had no physical evidence tying Bobby to a crime. No body, no scene, nothing concrete to prove that Nikki had even been harmed. When pressed about the polygraph, Bobby dismissed it as a misunderstanding. He claimed the question was whether he felt responsible for Nikki's disappearance. Of course I feel responsible, he said. I couldn't protect her from whatever happened. Detectives weren't convinced. Without evidence, the only step they could take was to label Bobby a person of interest. And while police believed he was holding something back, Nikki's family felt the same. They didn't just want him to mourn with them. They wanted him to open up, to finally say what he knew. Nikki's family wasn't just watching Bobby. They also looked to his past. His ex, April, had a reputation for being jealous of Nikki, and that jealousy made the family uneasy. Could she have had a hand in Nikki's disappearance? Meanwhile, Bobby felt the focus on him was unfair. To him, the police were wasting precious time and resources chasing the wrong lead. He insisted he would never hurt Nikki, the most wonderful person in his life, the woman he was about to marry. But the questions around him refused to fade. With no new leads, time began to stretch. Days slipped into weeks, and the silence only sharpened the family's frustration. Her brothers and sisters grew louder, criticizing police for chasing the wrong angles and ignoring what felt obvious. Every day without answers felt like a failure. They pointed to Bobby again, noting how he seemed more focused on how he looked during searches than on finding Nikki. To them, it was one more red flag. So the family took it on themselves. Every tip that came in, they followed. If someone thought they'd seen something, the McCowns piled into cars and went. They knocked on doors, scoured neighborhoods, tracked down rumors. Over and over, they came up empty. It was exhausting, chaotic, but they couldn't stop. For months, they combed through Richmond, turning the city inside out. But instead of embracing the help, investigators pushed back. They warned the family they were getting in the way, even threatened to arrest them. At one point, two of Nikki's brothers were arrested after pressing too hard. And still, the trail went dark. As the weeks dragged on, Bobby's place in the family fractured. A man once welcomed into their circle was now pushed out, the bond severed by suspicion. The search pressed forward, but the answers never came. Then 3.5 months after Nikki vanished on November 3, 2001, just as hope of finding her was beginning to dim, a break in the case finally came. Her vehicle, a 1990 GMC Jimmy 4x4 registered to her fiancé Bobby Webster, turned up abandoned. The SUV showed signs of tampering, the lock forced, the ignition damaged, the battery and stereo stripped out. But in the back seat sat something hauntingly ordinary, a laundry basket, neatly packed with folded clothes. The Montgomery County Sheriff's Office called the family with the news, and for a moment, hope surged. Nikki's car had been found in Dayton, Ohio, about 40 miles from Richmond. It was parked at the Meadows of Catalpa Apartments, and investigators suspected it had sat there since the very day she vanished. Inside, the driver's seat was pulled forward, adjusted for someone Nikki's height. It suggested she may have been the one to drive it there. Detectives went over the vehicle carefully, dusting for prints, looking for fibers, testing for blood. But there was nothing. No struggle. No useful fingerprints. Nothing that gave them answers. It was crushing. They had counted on the car to reveal something, anything. Instead, it left them with only one chilling detail: where it had been found. When detectives asked the family why Nikki's car might be at that complex, the answer came quickly. She had once lived there with her ex and the father of her daughter, Peyton, Stephen Johnston. And just like that, the focus shifted to him. Stephen still lived at the meadows of Catalpa, so when Nikki's SUV turned up there, detectives brought him in quickly. He didn't hide from his past. Yes, he admitted, he had cheated on Nikki. Yes, he had been abusive, but he insisted those days were behind him. Their relationship now, he said, was steady. They were co-parenting Peyton without conflict, and the animosity that once existed was gone. Stephen cooperated fully. He agreed to a polygraph without hesitation and passed. He even provided a DNA sample. In the end, investigators cleared him. That left two men on paper as persons of interest, but no suspects, no charges, no evidence pointing forward. So the questions multiplied. Had Nikki's car been planted at the complex to frame Stephen? Had an abductor driven it there, believing she still lived at that address? After all, it was still printed on her license. Or had Nikki herself driven there, only to cross paths with someone who meant her harm? The vehicle was supposed to be the break they had been waiting for. Instead, it opened new doors, and none of them led to answers. As detectives widened their focus, they made another discovery. Barely a quarter mile from where Nikki's car was abandoned, another man with a connection to her was right there in the neighborhood. His name was Tommy Swint. Tommy was a co-worker of Nikki's at the Montgomery Pre-Release Center, where he worked as a correctional officer. At first glance, he might have seemed like just another colleague, but detectives quickly realized Nikki and Tommy didn't see the relationship the same way. According to Nikki's sister, Michelle, Swint was looking at Nikki in a way she didn't return. He wanted more. Michelle said he was obsessed, so much so that when Nikki refused his advances, he once slashed her tires. The most glaring example came at her bridal shower when Tommy gave Nikki an inappropriate gift, lingerie. For her family, it was shocking, uncomfortable, and deeply out of place. It wasn't the kind of gesture a coworker or casual friend would make. And soon, detectives learned about his temper and a disturbing incident from years earlier. Michelle told officers about a day she stopped by Nikki's apartment. From outside, she could hear her sister screaming. When she opened the door, she saw Nikki sitting on a chair, her foot pressed against Tommy's chest, trying to push him away. "Help!" Nikki cried. "He's trying to force himself on me." Michelle said if she hadn't walked in at that moment, she feared her sister might have been overpowered. For investigators, the picture of Tommy Swint was darkening. Tommy was a married man with a daughter, but that didn't stop his advances toward Nikki. At the very same time, he was also carrying on a relationship with another coworker, a woman named Darlene. And Darlene wasn't just a colleague. She was also Nikki's friend. The tangled relationships only deepened the sense that Tommy had no boundaries. He was married, a father, and yet he continued to cross lines. Lines that made Nikki uncomfortable and left her family deeply uneasy. Detectives tried to bring Tommy Swint in for questioning, but he refused to cooperate. Without evidence to compel him, there wasn't much they could do. Like Bobby Webster and Stephen Johnston before him, Swint was listed only as a person of interest. Not a suspect, not charged with anything, just someone investigators believed might hold pieces of the puzzle. But with three men under that vague label and no concrete leads, the case slowed to a crawl. The investigation risked going cold. For Nikki's family, That was unacceptable. They refused to let her name disappear from the headlines. 1 year after she went missing, her sisters traveled to New York to share her story on national television. During that appearance, psychic Sylvia Brown told the family that Nikki had been killed the very day she disappeared, and that her remains would be found in a trench near the laundromat. Hopeful but desperate, the McCowns relayed the claim to police and organized a search around the area. Nothing came of it. Still, Nikki's family refuses to give up hope. They keep looking, praying. By 2004, 3 years after Nikki disappeared, her family tried a bold step. They partnered with a missing persons group and announced a $100,000 reward for information that could bring her home. With that kind of incentive, they believed someone had to speak up. At a press conference, they put out the challenge. The offer would only stand for 20 days. But the deadline came and went without results. No calls. No answers. Time continued to move forward, even as the family felt trapped in the same unbearable place. Nikki's mother and sisters were raising her daughter, Peyton, doing their best to give her a steady home while living with the gnawing uncertainty of what had happened. On the fifth anniversary, they returned to the laundromat, the last place Nikki was seen. Friends and family gathered for a vigil, lighting candles and sharing memories. 14-year-old Peyton stood before the crowd and begged for her mother's safe return. Despite their efforts, despite their voices, the case slipped further and further from public view. Then, without warning, 6 years after Nikki vanished, came a stunning development. Police get a tip. It concerns Tommy Swint, the man who once worked with Nikki, the man who once threatened her. Detectives have never taken him off their radar. In their minds, he is still a person of interest. They're convinced he knows something. Now, they're stunned to learn he's been hired as a police officer in the city of Trotwood, just outside Dayton. Shock, that's the only word for it. Shock that a man under scrutiny in an active disappearance case would be entrusted with a badge and a gun. Nikki's family was equally stunned. To them, it felt like betrayal. They were certain Tommy was connected to her disappearance. How could someone like this be sworn in as an officer of the law? How did it slip through the cracks? Their anger boiled over. Nikki's mother was adamant Tommy Swint had something to do with what happened to her daughter. Richmond detectives quickly informed Trotwood police. Tommy Swint was a person of interest. They had spoken to him multiple times about Nikki's disappearance. He was not just a name in the background. Trotwood's leadership acted fast. Tommy was told to resign or face termination. He resigned, but he didn't go quietly. Bruised by the public humiliation, Tommy and his lawyer struck back. He filed a lawsuit against the city of Richmond and its police department. At a press conference, he insisted he was never conclusively told he was a person of interest. "I was never identified as a suspect," he told reporters. "Never identified as a person of interest. Never charged with any crime. I was only interviewed because Nikki was someone I knew, a friend. Not once did they tell me I was under suspicion."
"But that they thought was friends with Nikki, they spoke to him, and it's a lot of them. You know, so that's why they spoke to me, because I was a friend of her. It was just routine question. Many people at the prison were questioned. Nobody was told that they was a person of interest or a suspect in the case."
"Clearly, if something came up in his character that demonstrated that he had a propensity to lie or be dishonest or to hide or conceal matters, clearly the polygraph examination would have revealed that."
"Actually, I was forced to resign. He said because I didn't mention it, that I was a person of interest in this case. But like I stated to him, Chief, I didn't know that I was a person of interest in this case. I didn't know I was a suspect in this case."
To Nikki's family, his words rang hollow. To investigators, his defiance only deepened the unease. Police maintained that Tommy had always known he was under scrutiny. His lawsuits fizzled without traction. but his firing and the cloud of suspicion tying him to Nikki thrust his name into headlines once again. The story spread. Local papers in Richmond, coverage in Dayton, segments on the evening news. And with it came something unexpected, a phone call. Dayton Police Department picked it up. On the other end, an anonymous caller delivered a startling message. Look harder at Tommy Swint. They didn't give much detail, just a chilling suggestion that investigators should re-examine him as a suspect. The lead pointed to a cold case from 16 years earlier. In 1991, forestry workers near Dayton had come across a grisly discovery, the body of 33-year-old Tina Marie Ivory. She had been wrapped in a blanket and bound with tape. Her cause of death, strangulation. Tina's life had been difficult. She had turned to sex work and was well known in the Dayton area at the time. Investigators preserved the blanket from the scene. Years later, DNA testing revealed a profile belonging to her killer. But in 1991, that meant little. Without a suspect to compare against, the profile sat useless. The evidence waited, frozen in time, until Tommy Swint's name surfaced again. Just like Nikki's case, the investigation into Tina Ivory's murder had gone nowhere for years. 16 years of silence, 16 years without suspects, arrests, or progress. Then, in November 2007, that anonymous tip dropped Tommy Swint's name. And suddenly, the case was alive again. Dayton detectives reopened the file. Their first priority was clear. Compare the DNA recovered from the 1991 evidence against Tommy Swint. They reached out to Richmond for help. And in an almost unbelievable twist, Richmond detectives already had a sample on hand. Months earlier, in the fallout from Tommy's forced resignation in Trotwood, Richmond investigators saw their opportunity. Tommy had been telling anyone who would listen, including through his lawyer, that he had gone above and beyond to cooperate with police. So Richmond detectives pressed him, "If you're really cooperating, prove it. Give us your DNA." At police headquarters, Tommy agreed. A sample was taken, sealed, and stored. And now, with Dayton detectives calling, that very sample was about to be put to use. Detectives often collect DNA with the long game in mind. If Nikki's remains were ever located, having Tommy Swint's profile on file would mean an immediate comparison. So when Richmond turned their sample over to Dayton's crime lab, analysts got to work. They compared Swint's profile against the genetic material recovered back in 1991. Traces left on the blanket and clothing that had been wrapped around Tina Marie Ivory. The outcome stopped them cold. It was a direct hit. Swint's DNA aligned with the DNA from Tina's case. But science alone couldn't close the file. DNA can place a person in contact, but it doesn't tell the full story of how, when, or why. Detectives still needed corroboration. They had to connect Swint not just to Tina's body, but to the act of murder itself. Detectives turned back to the physical evidence. Along with the blanket, investigators had also preserved the tape used to secure Tina Marie Ivory's body. With modern forensic tools unavailable in 1991, they took another look. This time, something new appeared. A faint palm impression embedded in the adhesive. It was a clue they hadn't been able to see before. The next step was obvious. Find something to compare it against. Dayton investigators headed south to Alabama, where Tommy Swint was living. They collected his fingerprints and brought him in for questioning. Swint agreed to talk, but detectives steered the conversation toward Tina Ivory, not Nikki McCown.
I didn't think I was ever going to get down here. And then I got lost, of course.
Yeah, we went to the left of the line, so the right of the line.
Tommy, you need to go to the bathroom or want some water, anything else to drink, or anything good?
Okay. Coffee? No.
Does that girl look familiar to you?
No.
Never date a girl look like that? Antonio look like that?
No.
Nobody that you've ever dated look like this gal right here?
No.
Mm-hmm. If I told you your name was Tina, would that ring a bell to you?
Not at all.
What if we told you we had evidence that would tie you?
I wouldn't believe it. You talking about tying me to her? Mm-hmm. I mean, is she alive or dead?
She's dead.
I wouldn't. Well.
What if I told you we had your DNA off her? Do you believe it?
No, I wouldn't believe it.
Do I have any reason to lie to you?
No, you don't have any reason to lie to.
And you've been in law enforcement long enough to know that if I want to come all the way down here from Dayton, Ohio, it's not certainly because of the beautiful Alabama weather. I'm coming down here for a reason.
Yeah.
That's a fair statement, wouldn't you think?
I would think so.
Okay. And the reason is because we're not you killed her.
So what now?
That you killed her.
Are you stating that I killed her?
I'm asking you, did you kill her?
Uh-uh.
Okay, I'm telling you that we have evidence that says that you did, what do you have to say to that?
Well, I have nothing to say to that. I mean, there's nothing I can say.
And Rick was saying, obviously, there's a reason why we're here.
Yeah.
Okay, we just didn't, you know, go, okay, point me to this person. Okay, we're talking about a homicide that happened in 1991. Okay.
I mean, certainly didn't pick Tommy Swint's name out of a hat, because I had never met you before until that day that I seen you at your house around Poplar.
Okay.
And because of this degree of scientific certainty that we have nowadays with the crime labs the way that they are, I mean, that's the only way that I knew who Tommy Swint even was. I mean, I've been in law enforcement for 30 years. I didn't know who Tommy Swint was. You know, I mean, I didn't know you from any other officer. I didn't know you from Detective King. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I'm coming at you for a reason, and that's why.
Obviously, again, this happened in 1991. You know what DNA is. You know what we do now of days. Like I said, you've been involved with law enforcement for long enough to understand. What we in the cold case unit is we take evidence from old cases and we resubmit everything back into the crime lab. And things that they were able to do back in 91, okay, obviously what we can do now is not what they could do then. So we resubmit everything. When we resubmitted all the evidence in this case, the evidence that we have in the case comes back to you as our suspect. So the bottom line is, you do have explaining to do. Okay, on why we have evidence that says you killed her. Obviously, you've worked with this for, I mean, obviously what I'm saying is, do I believe you're guilty? Yes, because of the evidence we have. So that'll take us into 18 years ago that you killed somebody. Obviously, it appears to me because of the fathering that you are, because of the good husband that you are, and because of the law enforcement dealing that you have, this has not been an easy thing for you to deal with over the years. I can just tell you that from sitting here. Okay? When you kill somebody, it probably was by accident. Doesn't seem like that you're a mean, vicious person.
You might have panicked.
Well, but the bottom line is, you did, and you've got to explain it. And I think you're ready to explain it after 19 years of living with us. I think you're ready.
And all due respect, and I understand what your job is, but I'm going to have to bring this to a close. And I'm quite sure I'll be talking to you again. And,
why do you want to bring it to a close?
Because my attorney wouldn't want me getting into this.
Who are you represented by?
Anthony Vanoy.
The Vanoy ID.
So you're telling me after 18, 19 years, you don't want to talk about this to us?
Well, you say this. I don't know what this is.
This murder.
Well.
This murder of her.
Okay.
Because I believe, like I said, I do believe that whatever it was an accident. It wasn't purposely that you went out that night and said, I'm going to kill Tina tonight, I'm going to kill somebody with the intent to do it. It happened. It was an accident. you overreacted, and now you've had to live with this. And obviously, and I mean, you could call it a cliche, you could call it whatever you want, but I do believe that after this amount of time that you're looking for a reason to get it off. You've lived with it. It's not an easy thing to live with because you're not a bad person.
Like I said, out of due respect, I want to end the conversation.
Okay.
This is what's going to be the situation is you are going to go home. Okay, but I also think that you understand that you'll see us again. Okay? And I guess in knowing that, I want you to understand a few things. I'll give you my card. Rick gave you his. You have the opportunity to talk to us. Okay?
Call Mr. Vanoy.
He knows us. I know him very well. I just got done with a case with him not too long ago. He knows I'm fair. He knows I'm not out to screw anybody. But people do have to have consequences for what they've done. You know, but again, it's been 19 years. How much, you know, you've done well, whatever you've done.
We'll be more than happy to sit back down with you.
And discuss things with you. Okay. And, you know, we have to take everything into consideration when we sit down and talk to you. And that's what we're willing to do. Obviously, your disadvantage or our disadvantage is you're in Alabama and we're in Ohio. Okay. So obviously that puts us both in a disadvantage of the easy contact. But again, we got phones. Very easy to get a hold of us. And it's very easy to get a hold of Anthony. I would suggest that you do get a hold of Anthony or whoever you are, your attorney, and have them get a hold of us. I would highly suggest that because the next time you may not have quite a quick opportunity to get a hold of him. So you may want to let him know what's going on.
Yeah, I can tell you the reason that we
come. Because we will, you know, obviously you understand we will. So you do need to get a hold of him.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's not... And I know you don't want to talk about it. I'm not going to talk about it anymore. I just have this statement to make is that there's additional evidence in this case, that being a fingerprint, not of a normal digit, but it's a second digit or possibly from a palm. That's why we took those today to have them compared as well. We'll see what happens from there. Okay?
And then we deal with extradictions and all that kind of stuff.
But I do appreciate your time. Appreciate your cooperation. Your patience, because I know it has been a long day. And like I said, things move a little slower down here than they do in Dayton, Ohio, don't they?
Yeah.
That's right.
Just understand, Tommy, we're trying to be fair as we can be, and we understand and we appreciate your cooperation with us, okay? Because I think you know just as well as I do, you know, sometimes it becomes, you know, you're an asshole, I can be a bigger asshole. And you work the street long enough and you work the jail. That's the way it is. You're an asshole, I'll be a bigger asshole. You cooperate, I cooperate. Yeah. And that's the way it is. If there's no reason for me to be an asshole, I'm not going to be. And that's basically, I think, what Rick and I can't disagree with at this point, that you've done everything that we've asked, and we appreciate that. And again, you do need to get a hold of an attorney and have them get a hold of us, and we can talk real soon.
Okay.
Is that fair?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any questions for us in addition to that?
Okay, it's out there in my briefcase, but I'll grab it so that you'll have it. And then they'll probably take you back to your car. And you can get a hold of us, Anthony can, or whoever, whether it be Anthony or whether it be somebody else.
Appreciate your time.
Okay?
Okay.
All right, take care. If you have any other questions come up also, you can give us a call.
Okay.
Despite their long suspicions, they still lacked any hard evidence tying him to Nikki. Back at the crime lab in Dayton, analysts put Swint's prints side by side with the impression recovered from the tape. The outcome left no doubt. The palm print wrapped around Tina Ivory's body belonged to Tommy Swint. With that identification, detectives finally had enough. A warrant for Swint's arrest was issued, the breakthrough they had waited years to secure. For Richmond detectives, what was happening in Dayton wasn't just significant. It was seismic. Their long-standing person of interest in Nikki's case was finally facing charges in another woman's murder. To them, it felt like the closest they had ever come to answers about Nikki. On February 3rd, 2010, a Dayton grand jury indicted Tommy Swint for the killing of Tina Marie Ivory. Investigators held their breath. Maybe, just maybe, this would lead to a confession about Nikki, too. Within the hour, a team moved in on Swint's home in Russell County, Alabama. Dayton detectives coordinated with local deputies and prepared to make the arrest. The clock had just struck one when officers advanced on the front door. And then, a gunshot shattered the air. They forced entry and found Swint inside, collapsed, a firearm still in his hand. He had done the unthinkable before he could be placed in handcuffs. For detectives, the moment was crushing. Rage and grief mixed, because with Swint's death, so too went the possibility of ever prying open the truth about Nikki. They believed it had been their one real chance. When Nikki's family was told, the news hit like a wave. The closure they had prayed for dissolved in an instant. Her mother, Barbara, cried out in anguish, "Lord, you didn't bring me this far to let this happen." "It's not right." The McCowns were certain Tommy Swint had played a role. They had wanted him to answer for it in a courtroom. Instead, all they were left with were questions echoing into silence. Even after Swint's death, Nikki's family refused to let go of the search for truth. They believed, and still believe, that someone close to him may be holding pieces of the puzzle that could finally explain what happened. Phone records from that day revealed Nikki had placed several calls, not only to her sister, but also to Darlene, the co-worker who was romantically involved with Swint. Nikki had been fixated on every detail of her upcoming wedding, right down to her hair. Graves' disease had caused thinning, and she'd asked Darlene about special vitamins she hoped to get before the big day. Darlene lived near the area where Bobby's truck was later discovered, and some say Nikki's car was even spotted in her driveway. Those details left Michelle uneasy. To this day, she has said plainly that she wants answers from Darlene. But years have stretched into decades, and Nikki remains missing. With the passage of time, both investigators and her family have had to face the grim likelihood that she was killed, most likely by Tommy Swint. Detectives say the absence of a body has always tied their hands. For the family, it's the uncertainty that cuts deepest. Still, they hang on to one possibility, that someone close to Swint knows more than they've ever admitted, and that someday, the truth of what happened to Nikki will finally come to light. What do you think about this tragic case? We usually end these stories with a conclusion, a court date, a conviction, some form of justice. But this one doesn't have that kind of ending. For 24 years, Nikki's family has lived without answers. Despite the fervent prayers of her mother, Barbara never lived to see her daughter found. She passed away on July 21st, 2020, one day before the 19th anniversary of Nikki's disappearance. Her father, Harvey, had died only a few years after Nikki vanished. And Bobby, though suspicion hung over him in the early days, over time, some in the family came to believe he had nothing to do with Nikki's disappearance after all. In fact, even 17 years later, he expressed deep sadness in an interview, saying how he was still single and lonely without her. Sadly, he passed away in 2021. But there is hope. Nikki's daughter, Peyton, is grown now. She has a daughter of her own. And she made a promise to her grandmother that she would carry the torch. Today, she advocates for her mother's case, handling media, public outreach, doing everything she can to keep Nikki's story alive. And in telling it here, I'm glad we can help her do just that. Tell me, do you believe Tommy Swint was behind Nikki's disappearance? Do you think Tommy had other victims and was potentially a serial killer? What about Darlene? Do you think she knows something about the case? Let's continue the conversation down in the comments section below. As always, I'll meet you there. In these stories, there are no perfect victims, just imperfect individuals navigating different roles in life. Nikki McCown was more than a missing bride, more than the unanswered questions of a cold case. She was a mother, a daughter, a sister, and a friend to many who now mourn her loss. Not because she was perfect, but because she was perfectly wonderful in their eyes. This is why I extend my gratitude to the victims for being beacons of love and light, despite any flaws that may emerge from their stories. So thank you, Nikki, for being an example of love and light. May you rest in eternal peace. That wraps up this episode of Sleuthy Stories. Thanks for joining me as we uncover the twists and turns of real-life cases. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you have a moment, please leave a rating. It really helps more true crime fans find us. Want to see the visuals that go with today's case? You can find the full video version on my YouTube channel, Sleuthy Lucy. Check the link in the description. I'll be back soon with another case. But until then, keep your wits sharp and your curiosity sharper.